Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Brittany Mangelson, and today we have on a very special guest that you are all well aware of. I am sitting down with Carla Long, and I must say that we are actually sitting down together at the same table, and I've already laughed so hard in this conversation that I've almost cried. So this is going to be good. I am thrilled to have you in my home, Carla.
Well, it's great to be here and drinking our nice, lovely, warm beverages. I stopped to get some chai tea lattes, which are actually decaffeinated, which you might not believe, but they do have plenty of sugar in them. So that's probably why I'm talking as fast as I am. But it's really great to be here.
It is. And the only reason why we're having decaf is because it's late at night and we're wimps.
By late at night, you mean 8:36.
Oh, this is going to be good. Fun conversation. So we are just going to chat with Carla. I realize that we have interviewed so many people in the church and new members of the church and millennials and historians, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we have not heard much from Carla.
Especially since I am none of those things. I'm not millennial. I'm not new to the church. I'm not a historian. I am none of those things. Just a host.
Just a host. So this is going to be fun. I am excited. So let's just dive right into this. Carla, you were born in Community of Christ. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the church in your early years? What did church life look for you?
Well, the most important part of my church life growing up was definitely going to church camp. I grew up in Mapleton, Kansas. That's my home congregation. Mapleton is a town of about 70 people. That's 70 people with three churches in it. There's Community of Christ. It was then, of course, RLDS. Yes. And the Methodist church. And then like this kind of what we just call the Christian church. It's just a non-denominational church. So three churches in a town of 70 people, and none of those churches liked each other at all, which is really awful. When I started growing up, you know, like I was in a really just a small town with just a pretty small congregation. We probably had anywhere from 25 to 30 people show up every Sunday. And I have two older sisters and a lot of cousins. And so they would come with us. So we had a pretty good Sunday school group. And, you know, like my dad was the pastor for a really long time and continues to be the pastor even now. And so they made sure that all of us had a lot of fun in the church, you know, but going to church camps was by far the best part of my growing up. We had have a church campground near Joplin, Missouri. It's called the Ozark Campground. But when I was growing up, it was called Wakanda Campground. So I was kind of weirded out when that Black Panther movie came out and they called that area Wakanda. I'm like, that's not right. Anyway. So anyway, going to church, we went to every church camp we could. We went to reunions when I was growing up, and those were really important to me. I have had such excellent friends still to this day from going to reunions and junior camps and junior high camps and senior high camps. I was actually baptized when I was 8 years old at my church camp. Anybody who's been to the Ozark campgrounds would know that the old swimming pool had a huge crack in it. And it was also really close to like this underground spring. So the water was always freezing cold. Like you had to gather up, even though it was super, super, super hot, you had to gather up all of your courage just to jump in. Like you had to like, okay, I can do it this time. No, I can do it this time. Mm. So it was really cold. So about my baptism, which my father baptized me, I had to gather up all my courage to do that too. And not for reasons that people might think, because it was so cold. Although I do remember, even at 8 years old, I do remember having some sort of experience in the pool. They let me like choose the music I wanted. And I think I chose All Things Bright and Beautiful because that was the most beautiful song that I could ever imagine.
That's such a Carla song.
Oh, I know. I could still sing it if anybody wants to hear it. But I do remember coming out of the water and I do remember feeling warm tears on my face. Remember thinking that something had happened there, even though I was only eight. So that is a memory that I have. I don't have a ton of memories from my childhood. just going to church camps, being with people that I absolutely adore and love, and always feeling accepted, always feeling wanted, and knowing in my home congregation that whatever I had to say was encouraged, even in business meetings, even before I was a member or whatever, people wanted to hear my voice. And I remember talking to my mom one time. I was like, I really wanted to give a testimony, to prayer and testimony service. And mom's like, well, Carla, if you have something to say, then you should definitely say it. And I was young. I was probably 5 or 6. So I went up to the microphone and I said something. I don't know what I said, but everyone's like, oh, that Carla. And I'm like, I know. So growing up in Community Christ was really wonderful, even though we only had like maybe 2 families in my whole high school that were Community of Christ. And we got called Mormons a lot. And I was like, I don't think we are. And I had to look at someone else. Are we? No, Carla, you're not. Okay, good. So, you know.
So it sounds like from a young age, you were always just aware that your voice mattered, that your thoughts mattered, that, you know, you, just your personhood mattered, which is, I think, a gift that not every religious child gets. I think a lot of times in church, we try to, you know, shut kids up or out and, you know, not necessarily give them the time of day. But that is one thing that I've really appreciated about Community of Christ is that kids are actually utilized and their giftedness is developed. So I guess just moving right along the timeline, I know you went to Graceland. So actually, no, backing track a little bit. What, and not to like give your age on the podcast.
Please
I mean,
do.
We can, but please. I'm just wondering... I mean, and I know the answer to this, but what time frame are we talking about? Like when you talk about being a kid in Community of Christ, what decade are we at?
Well, I will just say my mother put out a Christmas card just this year and she put my age on the Christmas card and not my sister's age for some reason. She's like, oh, my daughter who's 41 just had a baby. Thanks, Mom. My sisters, my 2 older sisters, oh, they don't get their ages mentioned. So yes, gentle and kind listener, I am 41 years old. I was born in 1977. And so I was 7 years old in 1984 when the Section 156 came out. And my mother was ordained very quickly after that. So I've never in my life really known a time when women were not up front. I don't remember really much before I was 7 years old. So I could have had my mother baptize me. I just didn't. I don't know why I didn't at this point in my life, but I just didn't. So yeah, we're talking 80s, 90s. I graduated high school in 95. So yes, I did go to Graceland. I wasn't always planning on going to Graceland. But I remember I was looking at all these different schools. I wanted to be a doctor, which is ridiculous because I hate gross things like blood and poop and throw up. Like I can't stand any of those things. But I wanted to be a doctor because I was like valedictorian in my high school. And that's what I thought valedictorians had to do. Granted, my high school class was 37 kids. So
don't sell yourself short.
It's not like it was really tough. And 90% of us were in FFA, Future Farmers of America, including myself. I really enjoyed Future Farmers of America. Not that there's anything wrong with farmers and not that farmers aren't smart, but I'm moving on. I'm so sorry. Anyway, so I wasn't sure I was going to Graceland. And then I was taking a nap, like it was in April, and I'd already applied to go to Graceland because I went to Spectacular, which is a camp at Graceland. And I woke up from this nap and I knew with an absolute certainty that Graceland was where I needed to be. And so I went upstairs and I was like, Mom, Dad, I'm going to Graceland. They're like, great. Like they're like, because my oldest sister had gone, but my middle sister had not gone to Graceland. And from that moment on, it was like everything fell into place. I'd already been accepted. I'd already applied. Some scholarships fell into place that were really good because Graceland's fairly expensive for a liberal arts school. And, so anyway, I ended up at Graceland. Graceland was really good for me. I learned a lot. I went to church sometimes, but I found myself really questioning whether or not God existed. And I think that's a really important time in your life when you should question those things. There's no really other time in your life when it's easy to question those things because you're with a community that is pushing you and wants you to grow and wants you to expand and wants you to question. And that's exactly what it did to me. So I went to church sometimes, I didn't go to church sometimes. And I felt really kind of cool about that. Like I had all this autonomy and I could decide what I wanted to do. And then, you know, Graceland was wonderful and hard all at the same time. I had this boyfriend when I was a junior, and my family hated him. They really didn't like him. And I was, you know, I really wanted to be with him. And we ended up breaking up at the end of my junior year, and then he started dating my best friend. And my whole life was like a Jerry Springer episode my senior year. Like, it was nasty. Like, it was not fun. Super fun fact, just ran into both of them when I was home for Christmas in Pittsburgh, Kansas. So
they're still together?
They are. They have three kids, aww, which is nice. Yeah. And we're friends again. It's fine. He was not the person for me. If you're listening to this, you know that by now. So my life was really tough at Graceland that second, my senior year. Luckily, I was only there for half the year. I went to student teach in Independence, Missouri at Truman High School. I was going to be a math teacher. I really enjoyed teaching math. And it was really soon after that, you know, right after that, I got a teaching job in Independence at Fort Osage High School. And this is a fun little story. So Independence is, you can't swing a dead cat in Independence without hitting a Community Christ person. So I was applying for a job at Fort Osage High School. And the woman who was the principal, one of the four principals there, she goes, "I know you." I'm like, "No, you don't." She's like, "Oh, yes, I do. You went to Spectacular in the late 90s or early 90s, which is a camp at Graceland." And she's like, "You played all four major sports and you were only supposed to play two major sports. So you kind of cheated." I was like, "Oh my gosh." So she remembered me and hired me anyway. So I taught at Fort Osage High School for 3 years. And that was from 1999 to 2002. So I'm going to back up just a slight little bit. After college and this, you know, like my Jerry Springer year, like when everything was just like kind of nasty, I really just wanted to leave the country. Like, I've always wanted to travel. I've always wanted to leave. So I applied for World Service Corps. I applied for Peace Corps and I got into Peace Corps and they were getting ready to send me to Africa and I was ready to go. And then I had a conversation with my dad and he goes, "You know what, Carla, maybe you just teach for 3 years, get a master's degree and then see what happens after that." And that was the best advice I'd ever gotten, actually, because I taught for 3 years. I got a master's degree in education from the University of Missouri in Kansas City. And then after those 3 years, I felt God calling in a way that I had never felt God calling before in my life. I really enjoyed teaching, but at the end of those 3 years, like the last semester of those 3 years, I would wake up in the morning with like this feeling of dread in my stomach. The kids were my students. I loved them so much, but they were so needy. You know, like I would have a girl come up to me on a Monday morning and she'd be like, "Miss Long, I had sex this weekend. I don't know what to do." I'm like, "What you do is not tell your math teacher." But I would be like, "Okay, so we need to go, probably let's go talk to a counselor." And, or, you know, like a student came out to me. It's like, I'm gay. And I think that if I tell anybody in the school, I'm going to get shot. And I'm like, "You might be right about that." In the 3 years I was there, three kids brought guns to school. And this was before that was a thing. So these kids weighed really heavy on my heart. And not only was that happening, but I was feeling like this nudge that I'd never felt before. In those 3 years that I was teaching, I went to church and I was singing with a singing group called the Center Place Singers. So
I don't know this.
I do not love that theological, title. It's Center Place Singers, but I really enjoyed singing with them. And we had a great time. So I went to church but I also, like, I was living with my best friend named Tara, and we never locked our apartment door because there was always a party ready to happen. Like, we had a lot of fun. Like, we had parties all the time, and it was an awesome way to live. So I was actually a little bit mad when I felt God nudging me, God calling me, because I had so much to do. I really wanted to write a math textbook. I mean, I loved teaching math, and I had all these great ideas for how I could write this math textbook. And I was having so much fun. And I thought, gosh, if I start working for God, I'm not going to have any fun anymore at all. So I was really disappointed that God was calling me. But it was something that I couldn't deny. I wasn't happy where I was. I wasn't happy teaching math anymore. And it was time to make a change. So I applied for World Service Corps, which is an organization with the church where you can go to a different country for the summer or a year or 2 years. And I signed up for a year. And again, just like going to Graceland, everything seemed to fall into place. I don't remember having to get the shots. I don't remember the interview. I don't remember paying the money. I just remember all of a sudden they're like, hey, you want to move to the Philippines? I was like, where's that? So I ended up moving to the Philippines in October 2002. I had never traveled out of the country by myself before. I'd been to Africa for 3 weeks with a Graceland group, and I had been to South America with my family, but I'd never traveled by myself, and certainly not that far by myself. And I had like all of this money in a wallet stuck in my pants, and I was like on the plane. I'm like, everyone's trying to steal this from me. They weren't, Carla. They're not. I was a little terrified, and I don't think I slept for the 30 hours that I traveled. I don't think I slept a wink. So I made it to Manila, and my host family, Josie and Chito Magabilian, picked me up, thank God, and we traveled the 4 hours up to my new home, which was Binalonan, Pangasinan, on the island of Luzon, which is the northernmost island. And I started my life in the Philippines, and I was like, there are many moments when I was like, what in the world am I doing here? Like, my jobs were to teach in a school that was owned by the church. I taught English. I taught computers. Mostly I taught how to turn it on and copy and paste. that was pretty much my lesson plans for 6 months. And there's like a whole group of sweet little second graders back in 2002 who probably have a Midwestern accent because the teachers just wanted me to read through a list of English words. So I'd be like, couch. And the whole class would be like, couch. I'm so sorry. They definitely have my accent now. And I sang songs with them and played games. So I taught in the Filipino school and I supported the congregation. And I didn't even know how to support a congregation. I had never been a church minister before. I preached my first sermon in the Philippines. It was and it's half in Tagalog because I was also learning their language of Tagalog, which is their national language. And a woman in the back laughed the entire time during the sermon because I did it so poorly. And I practiced so long. Like, I'd written out the entire sermon. My tutor and I, we had translated it. And I practiced and practiced and practiced. And this woman in the back still laughed the whole time. And I remember what I talked about. I talked about a mountain. And in Tagalog, it's boondock. So when you say I live out in the boondocks, you're speaking Tagalog.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So I'm not sure. The one thing I am sure of about the Philippines is that I was really lonely. In Independence, I had like hundreds of friends. Like we did things all the time. I was never without like 20 different people. And in the Philippines, I really only had myself. And that was when God and I became really, really good friends. And I realized that what a huge impact God could have on someone's life. Yeah, like I started learning things. Like I didn't know anything about the lectionary and Community Crisis started using the lectionary. I didn't know anything about preaching or scriptures or anything. Like I didn't know anything like that. I'd taken New and Old Testament at Graceland as an undergrad. So I knew some, probably more than I thought I did. But I mean, I just started learning things, mm-hmm. really enjoying it. And so I was there from October 2002, and I was supposed to spend a whole year there. But in March of 2003, the United States was getting into the war in Iraq in 2003. And the war was scheduled to start in mid-March. So I got a call from World Church in early March, and they said, hey, Carla, having you in the Philippines is becoming too much of a liability because the Filipinos are really angry with the United States for starting this war. And every week we'd hear about an American being shot and killed, an American being kidnapped, an American business being bombed in the Philippines, usually not on my island, usually in the southernmost island called Mindanao. But they're like, you're become too big of a liability. You have to get out of the Philippines. You cannot serve the entire year. And it's true. While I was there, things were heating up. There's a group called the NPA, the National People's Army, and it was starting to get a little bit kind of active. And I definitely don't look Filipino. If you don't know what I look like, I'm very, very pale. I have really, really blonde hair. And so I stood out like a sore thumb everywhere I went. I would be walking in the village and like children would be following me and they would be yelling, "Puti, puti, puti, puti," which in Tagalog means white. And the more they say it, the whiter you are. So, so they just kept screaming it at me. And I'm like, I get it. I'm white. And I was standing in line. I was just wearing shorts, like not short shorts or anything. But I was wearing shorts. And I was standing in the bathroom line at the mall in the Philippines. And this woman came up and grabbed my leg and she goes, "You're so white." I'm like, "Yep." Thanks. I don't know what to say. So it was like living in a fishbowl. Oh, yeah. And I was starting to learn Tagalog in a preschool at first. Like, they thought that might be the best place for me to learn. It was me, a 23-year-old person, and three-year-olds. So I was sitting in a chair with the rest of the three-year-olds, and we were learning our numbers. Isa, dalawa, tatlo, apat, anim. And I'm like, why am I here? I did it for a whole day. I was in there for a whole day. And then we went outside to play. The kids were like calling me a name and telling me to come over and push them on swings. And so I went over, and then I went over to the teacher. I'm like, "What are they calling me?" And the teacher's like, "We don't want to tell you." I'm like, "No, you tell me what they're calling me right now." They were calling me the white giant. I'm like, I cannot learn Tagalog in this preschool anymore. I need to find something else. Oh my gosh, I forgot all about that. They called me the white giant. So anyway,
hilarious.
So yeah, I had to get out of the Philippines. So I left the Philippines and I was pretty sad to leave because they say it takes you 6 months to get used to a culture. Mm-hmm. And I was on a culture shock roller coaster for sure. You know, like there was no doubt I had been on a roller coaster for the last 5 months while I was there. So I was pretty mad that I'd done all the hard work and I didn't get to reap any of the benefits because I was starting, my Tagalog was starting to come along and I was starting to kind of understand how people acted and reacted. But anyway, the church pulled me out and I got back in March. Which was actually kind of nice because my first niece was born in April, so I got to be around for that. But the church said, "Okay, so Carla, you signed up for a year contract. You can either quit your contract, you can work in independence for the rest of your contract, you can move to Taiwan, or you can move to Australia." I was like, "Send me to Australia. Why not?" So in July of that year, I packed up and moved to Australia. And the Australian Mission Center, at that point, and they probably still are, I have no idea, was a fairly wealthy mission center. They just sold a big piece of property on Sydney Harbor. And so they're like, "Well, Carla, we're thinking about just buying you a house and giving you a car." And I was like, "Okay."
If you want to,
I'll take it. If you want to buy me a house and give me a car, I'll do those things. So I was living about 3 hours north of Sydney in a town called Taree. And about, I don't know how many people, maybe 30,000 people live in Taree. And yeah, they bought me a house and let me have a car. And I'm like, "You guys are crazy," because I definitely went in, you know, I'm driving on the wrong side of the road, the left side of the road. I definitely ran over one of my youth's feet one time. She's like, you're on my foot. I'm like, "No, I'm not." She's like, "Yeah, you drove on my foot." I'm like, "Oh, I don't know what I'm doing." I don't know why they let me do it. So that year was an awesome year. Oh my gosh, that was like the biggest growth year of my life. But besides that, I also got to go surfing every week because my friend Adam gave me his old surfboard and I was 10 minutes from the beach. Nice. So I went surfing every week. But one of my main jobs was to teach in an Aboriginal school. The church owned this, the church had a building in Taree and some Aboriginal people were using the building and like teaching Aboriginal kids about their culture. I was brought in to teach them whatever else they wanted to learn. Because the sad thing is in Australia, Australians treated their Aboriginal people as badly as we treated our Native Americans. Maybe worse. So now if you can prove that you're an eighth Aboriginal in Australia, you can earn, the government will give you enough money to live on. So you don't have to get a job. You don't have to do anything to make a living. they'll just give you money. And it's a big problem because Aboriginals, a lot of people who just get that money just end up drunk in the streets by 10 a.m. Like it's a really big problem. And when the Sydney had the Olympics, they didn't want a lot of Aboriginals in Sydney kind of like messing up their vibe. So they sent all of their Aboriginals up to Taree, where I lived. So there was a lot of people who needed a lot of help in Taree. So we ran a school called, oh gosh, I don't remember the name of the school. It'll come to me. So I taught them whatever they wanted to learn because a lot of these kids had dropped out of 10th grade. And if you can get your 10th grade certificate in Australia, that's kind of a big deal. So I taught them whatever they wanted to learn. And then Harry and Ellie, who also ran the school, the Aboriginals who ran the school, they taught them all about the Aboriginal culture. So I learned about the Aboriginal culture too. I got to do dot paintings and I learned what they all meant. And it was pretty cool. It was hard. It was really hard, but it was pretty cool. My other jobs were to start a youth group and then support three congregations in that area, Foster Tuncurry, Taree, and Wingham. And so I was there from July to the next July. And I was really enjoying it. I got to do church camps and our campground in Australia, Teona, we own part of a beach. I mean, so part of their fun is like going to the beach every day and surfing. And it is a gorgeous campground, even if it does have a highway running through the middle of it, which it does. So Teona was fantastic. So for my story though, it was a pretty big deal. So I came back to the United States in January because I was supposed to be a groomsman in a wedding. I was really good friends with a groom. So I came back to the United States in January. And while I was at my parents' house, I got a call from the apostle from Australia, Dave Brock. He called and Dave goes, Carla? And I'm like, Dave? He's like, what are you doing there? I'm like, I'm here for a wedding. Why are you calling my parents' house? And he goes, I just called to talk to you. I'm like, but you didn't know I was here. He's like, yeah. Is your dad around? I was like, what? So what I did not realize is that he was calling to call me to be a priest. So my first call to priesthood was through the apostle Dave Brock. And my dad was still technically my pastor. So my dad was the one who had to get it going. So I was called to be a member of the priesthood. And I was ordained in Australia. I like to say I left Australia with three things. One, I left with a priesthood role. Two, I left with a potty mouth. I learned how to swear like a sailor in Australia because that's what they do. And three, I left with a caffeine addiction. I never liked coffee before, but now I loved coffee. So Australia gave me those three very important parts of my life. Priesthood, swearing, caffeine.
I love it.
But also, you know, like Australia changed me. After when I left Australia, I realized that I needed to be a minister. There was no other life for me, even though I had already applied at UMKC to get a PhD in mathematics or math education, I mean, and I'd already was given a job teaching master's degree or master's students at UMKC. I realized that that's not where I wanted my life to be anymore. God had messed all of that up. God had ruined my life, my cool math life. And God had inserted himself or herself or itself, I don't know, directly within me. And I just couldn't shake God loose anymore. So yeah, I came back from Australia and I taught at UMKC for a year. And then I took myself out of that PhD program and started seminary with Community of Christ. So I paid for it on my own the first year, and then the church hired me. And then they paid for it, which was great. Do you have a question, or am I talking too much?
No, this is great. It's just like story time with Carla. I love it. Yeah, I was wondering, I mean, you basically just answered what my question was going to be, is when did the whole intersection of seminary and working for the church and quitting your math teaching career, you know, come to place? But it sounds like it all kind of happened pretty rapidly.
Yeah, I was driving up. It was a really rainy day. I remember I was driving from my parents' house in Mound City, Kansas, up to UMKC to talk to my, what's that person called who's in charge of you at school? Oh, whatever. Anyway, I was driving up to talk to her, and she, on the way, I just started crying. I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. This isn't who I am anymore. I'm not a math teacher anymore, even though I love it and I love teaching. And I think teaching is a great way to start being a minister. It's not where I felt called anymore. So, and I didn't know if she'd let me out of it, but she did. So I just remember that moment very clearly, just crying my eyes out. And it was hard coming back from Australia. I had reverse culture shock in the worst way. Mm. I would wake up crying. I was like, I don't know who I am anymore. And my friends who I used to have tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of fun with, I was different, but they were the same. And so like they had to get used to me, the new Carla, and I had to be okay with that, which was also difficult. So that year I was back in Independence was a bit of a transition year for me. I was just trying to figure out who I was and who God was actually calling me to be. So I applied with Community of Christ to be anything. I applied to say, I'll serve however you want me to serve. Cause I was just desperate to serve because I had such a huge experience in Australia and the Philippines, but mostly Australia, that my life, I was just so happy with doing what I was doing. And I knew it was the thing for me. So the church said, hey, do you want to move to California? I was like, yeah. So I moved to California. I moved to this town called Manteca, which in Spanish is Manteca, and it means lard. Those little packages of lard. And it's not a nice little town. It's probably an hour and a half east of San Francisco and about an hour south of Sacramento. So in our area, I was at the Sierra Pacific Mission Center, and we went all the way to Oregon, all the way down to Bakersfield, and then all the way over to Nevada. We had one congregation in Nevada, in Reno.
Wow.
And it was a pretty big area. I would drive like 30 to 35,000 miles every year going up and down the state. And I preached and I taught and I was the Mission Center financial officer. And I don't think I did a great job because I didn't really know what I was doing. But the people in California were very kind and they loved me very, very much. And I was better by the end. But I don't think I was amazing at it, but I really loved in California. I learned how to be vulnerable in California. So after I became an elder, I could become an appointee, which they had those positions back then. And we're talking like the years 2005 to 2011. Mm-hmm. So I applied to be an appointee, and after the interview, if you pass the interview, you have to go through a psychological evaluation, and you take a lot of different tests, an IQ test, a what you're good at test, a personality test, all these things. And then you're evaluated by a psychiatrist. And she told me some things about myself that were really hard to hear. She told me that I was better at fooling everyone for how I really was than anyone she'd ever met. Like I could keep the real Carla hidden so deeply that no one would ever see it except for me. And no one had ever been that blunt to me about it. And so it scared me. Because I knew that in order to be a good minister, you have to be genuine. And I went back to California and I talked to some friends about it. She's like, and one of my good friends, Jenny, she's like, yeah, Carla, I actually feel like I don't really know the real you. So I worked really, really hard at vulnerability after that. I tried to let the real me out because I was so terrified that people wouldn't like me anymore if I weren't funny and fun and happy all the time. And even though I had never put that into words or in my brain, it was the truth. So also while we were in California, I learned a lot more about myself. There was this man I really, really liked a lot. And I thought that he might be the man, the one. And right around that time, my boss left. Barb Carter, who's an apostle right now, she and I were really close. She was Mission Center president, and she moved to be an apostle. And then my best friend, Tara, got married. And I had a difficult time with all three of those things because the man I really liked did not like me in that way. Barb Carter moving and Tara getting married. So I was in a really, really bad place, like a really bad place. Like I knew that camps were coming up And I did like 6 camps per summer. I did a lot of camps that in California. Like, it was great because most of them were in Santa Cruz, California, and that's the place you want to be. So I was in such a bad place. But I knew I had to perform. So I just took all of these nasty, nasty feelings, this feeling of hurt and disappointment and loss and pain, and I just zipped them up within myself. And I just shoved them down to a place that I thought I could manage. And then I tried to do my job, and it was horrible. I did such a horrible job. I was crying all the time. I was just a mess. I couldn't get it together. I couldn't do anything. So after that horrible, awful summer, I went to therapy. The church offers employees free therapy through their employee assistance program. And I was like, I'm going to have to do it. I don't even know how to fix all of this nasty, gunky, gross junk within me. So I went to therapy, and she was really good. I hated it. Like, I just went and cried the entire time. Yeah. But I mean, she made me take these things, unzip and just take these things out and examine them and look at them. And once they'd seen the light of day, they weren't that bad. And they were something that I could get through. And that has been a really good lesson for me. Since then, I realized that if you let things air out and not just push them down to a yucky place, they're definitely, you can handle them, or I can handle them. And I hope other people can handle them too. So that was a huge lesson in my life. And I'm really, really glad I did therapy. And I actually think, you know, I could probably use some now. I think everybody could use some therapy, all the time.
Yep.
It was a really big deal for me because I'm from Kansas. I don't think there's any therapist in Kansas. I mean, there's probably one in a city. So California, if Australia started me on the path to ministry, it was really California that opened me up and taught me how to be a minister. Mm. And taught me that vulnerability is absolutely essential to being a minister, and that you got to, I've used this analogy a zillion times, but you got to get that mask, airplane mask on yourself first before you can help someone else. So, you know, you got to get your stuff together. And if your stuff isn't together, you are not helping anyone in any way, shape, or form. It's really impossible. And even if you think you are helping, you're not helping yourself because you're not being real for yourself. So California was good for me. What am I forgetting? You have any questions? Any thoughts? Okay. So in 2011, that was the chair. Sorry. Anywho, in 2011, the church called and they were like, hey, Carla, they gave me a choice of 2 jobs because the one in California was, they were shifting some things in California. So that job wasn't going away, but they were asking if I wanted to go somewhere else. So I had the choice of two jobs. And one of them was being the Mission Center Financial Officer for all of Europe. And I was like, what? What? And that sounded really intriguing to me. Like, I got to travel and like really cool, even though I was terrified, and the other job sounded really great too. I was like, you know what? Because I really was going to take the other job. The other job really sounded good. But it was another one of those moments. I thought about the job in Europe, and it just seemed like all these doors opened up and like it became easy. And so I chose Europe. So I moved back to Independence and I started traveling to Europe 6 to 7 times a year. And as the Mission Center Financial Officer for all of the countries in Europe and Eastern Europe, the Netherlands, Spain, France, Germany, Hungary, Russia, Ukraine, Georgia. Oh gosh, I'm sure I'm missing some. And I had a lot to learn. Like for a while, for those 5 years I was in Europe, I could speak very intelligently about exchange rates of florins and kroner. Oh, Norway, florins and kroners and lari and rubles and grivna. Euros. Like it was I learned a lot. And I also learned a lot about the people in Europe. People in Europe, one time, a good friend of mine in the Netherlands, she said to me, she's like, you know, Carly, Europeans don't really like Americans that much. I'm like, what? She's like, no, we don't like when people are happy or friendly or loud or obnoxious. And I go, why would they send me here? They do not like those people. Because I have everything you just said. I'm loud and friendly and obnoxious and happy. She's like, yeah, we were wondering the same thing.
Oh, where do you know?
Interesting. One thing I did learn, Europeans, especially Northern Europeans, are very, very happy to tell you the truth. Hmm. Like, they think it's the kind way to do it. And they think Americans are very unkind because we're so polite and because we say, just kidding. They think it's very kind to be like, you look terrible today. They think that's kind.
Oh,
because they want you to know, because they don't want you thinking you look good.
Got to improve.
You know, just do your best. Just try harder. So, but I mean, I can see that, you know, like Americans, we do kind of hide behind this polite kind of thing, and we're not real with people. Yeah. And Europeans are very real. So I had to learn how to not let that hurt my feelings a little bit, because it did hurt my feelings. But Europe was tough for me. I don't know any of the European languages. I started learning Spanish, so I know some Spanish, not a lot of Spanish. Luckily, I could get around fairly easily, and I'm good at miming, so I could usually get what I needed. And I was all over Europe all by myself a lot. I went all over the Netherlands all by myself. I drove through, back and forth across Germany at least 6 times all by myself. You know, I drove through France, which was the most terrifying experience of my life. I only drove for 45 minutes in Paris, and I got flipped off 4 times, and I got screamed at in French. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. It was so scary to drive in Paris. I never want to do that again. I drove all across Spain. I drove from Madrid all the way down to, what's the name of the city that's Kansas City, sister city? Seville, which is about a 9-hour drive. Oh. And I mean, I went all over. Oh, and I drove in Russia, and I've been all over Ukraine and Georgia. Kuzma and I, my now husband Kuzma, who is a 70 in Ukraine, and he has a great story too. He and I ordained the first minister we have in Georgia, the country of Georgia, in Tbilisi, the capital. I barely mentioned this. I met my husband Kuzma in November 2011, right after I'd moved back to Independence. He was there for World Service Corps, and he was he was working in the legal department because he's a lawyer, but he was also working in the Children's Peace Pavilion gluing flags together, which is very important as well. And I met him in November in Independence, and you know, we became friends. And then he was working as a lawyer in Kiev, so he went back home to Kiev, and his father had founded the church in Ukraine, and his father was the first baptized member, his mother was the second, and Kuzma was the third baptized member in Ukraine. And he worked as a lawyer still for about a couple years, and then he started working for the church, and then we started traveling around together. We went to Russia together and Georgia together, and we fell in love. But we couldn't do anything about that because I wasn't going to move to Ukraine because they were at war with Russia at the time. And he couldn't move to the United States because he's working for the church in Ukraine. So there was nothing that could be done about it. So we didn't do anything about it and until we could. So in March of 2016, he was no longer working for the church, and he came over for World Conference. And he asked me to marry him. And I was like, okay, that sounds fun. So we got married in June of 2016. And, you know, like meeting Kuzma in Europe was definitely one of the biggest things that happened to me in Europe. Because I never wanted to get married. I never wanted to have children. I thought it looked kind of boring and really expensive. that sounded like a thing I didn't really want to do. But he changed all that for me. So that was like another opening up of me, because falling in love sounded really scary. and letting yourself be that vulnerable to someone else sounded like something I wasn't sure I wanted to do, even wanted to do. And then when it did happen, I was just like, wow, this is hard. So yeah, so Europe was a 5 years assignment, and I fell in love with the people there. I fell in love with the food there. I fell in love with the cultures and what I'm learning. And I fell in love with seeing Jesus through their eyes, because they understand Jesus and God in the same way, yet a different way than what we do. And so when I got to understand that, I got to really kind of just revel in knowing that people can see Jesus and God in so many different ways and still be so valid. And understanding that it's okay to see and understand God how they do. And it's okay for me to understand God how I do. Because God's mystery, like, no one really understands who God is. So me getting to see the piece of their God helped me to fill in more pieces of mine. So Europe was really important in part of my, as part of my life. And I am incredibly grateful for the opportunity to travel to all these amazing and incredible and awesome places and to meet these incredible, awesome, and amazing people, people that I still miss to this day. You know who you are.
Yeah, the diversity of the church that you've experienced, I think, is really awesome. And with that comes, well, because our listeners should know by this point, there's not a lot of correlation in Community of Christ, meaning uniformity, where this congregation looks just like this one. There's a lot of leeway on how a congregation worships and how they live out mission and all these different things. And so I can only imagine how interesting it would be to, in, you know, such a short period of time over the course of however many years, 10-ish years?
10-ish years what?
Like from the time that you went to World Service Corps to Europe-ish? Mm-hmm. Okay. yeah, to travel around to all those different corners of the earth and to see the church through that those cultures, I think, would just be
amazing. Been so incredibly, and in some ways, I hate to use this word, but blessed, you know, because I think it gets overused, but it has been just this huge blessing in my life. Like, I have lived on 3 continents and I've served the church on 4 continents, and getting to meet the people that I've met and being around the people that I've been around has totally shaped my worldview. I am definitely not patriotic by any stretch of the imagination to the United States. And I hate using this phrase too, because I think it's overused, but I do feel like more of a citizen of the world, because I've lived with the Australians. I've seen how they view Americans, and I've lived with the Filipinos. I see how they view the world and the United States. I've been with the Europeans a lot. You know, like when I said I travel over there 7 times a year, I'd be over there for 3 to 4 weeks at a time. So it's a good part of the year that I was in Europe. So, and living kind of as a European, and I loved seeing the world from their eyes. So it has been a real gift, a real gift. And now I'm in Utah.
I know. So let's get to that.
Utah.
And not only are you in Utah, but you're in Utah County.
Which is the Utahiest of the Utahs. Like, it is. It is so Utah.
Carla and I just live a few minutes away from each other now, which is
Great.
And I just keep apologizing for different things. And she runs into, I'm like, oh yeah, sorry about that. We live in Utah County. So I'm actually really interested in hearing this part of your story. I mean, the whole thing's been interesting, but I have heard pockets of it before. But I haven't really heard from your perspective how it was to have the Utah job presented.
Well, when everything started getting shifted around in the church in March of 2016, I knew that they were taking the European jobs and shifting them down. Like, there was not going to be a job for me in Europe anymore. There was a man who is the bishop in England, and he's British, and it's and he ended up taking all three mission centers, which was really only fair. He's British. He should not have to move anywhere else. I'm American. I was already living in the United States. It made sense for me to not work in Europe anymore. So I was presented with a job in Utah by Robin Linkhart and Scott Murphy. And I was actually in Rotterdam in the Netherlands at the time. And I was like, what? You want me to do what? Because I'd only been a mission center financial officer the entire time with the church. I had never done anything else. And the idea that I got to do something else was pretty exciting for me. It's not that I didn't like being a mission center financial officer. I liked being in the middle of stuff, but I was ready to try something else. So I was like, okay. So, and they're like, well, you have a while to think about it. I'm like, how long? They're like, a day. I was like, what? That might be wrong. I might have had more than a day, but it felt like a day. So I was like, okay. So I called my parents and I called my best friend and we talked about it. And, you know, it sounded really fun. It sounded like ministry that I could really get behind, you know, like being with people and podcasting, with talking, which I love all those things. I love being with people. I love eating with people. I love talking. I love all of those things. So it sounded like a ministry that it could be like something I could really have fun with. So of course I said yes. And Kuzma asked me to marry him and we got married and then we moved out here together in September 2016.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. So he was well aware that you were going to move to Utah. So by asking you to marry him, it was him saying
yes to Utah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually he was another one that I called. He was one that I called and said, so they want to move me to Salt Lake City. He's like, where's that? Like, it was in America. It's in Utah. He's like, okay. Yeah. So it was, I think for him and Kuzma, you can correct me later if I'm wrong, but for him, you know, America's America. Hmm. And he really hates the humidity in the Midwest. Hates it. So there's no humidity in Utah. He likes that. And Kuzma's a 70. I think, I don't know if I mentioned that before. So Robin Linkhart got two ministers for the price of one, which I don't think she was upset about at all. Robin, you can also correct me on that if I'm wrong.
Two brilliant ministers.
Brilliant.
Kuzma's a great 70.
He is. So we moved out here in September 2016, and I was here for 2 days, and then I went straight to a women's retreat up in Red Cliff, and that was by far the smartest move ever, because I just jumped in, and I met like probably 40 women who are amazing and incredible, and I learned a lot that weekend. I started these relationships with people that I just have fallen in love with, and also that weekend, I caught a glimpse of the deep, deep pain that people are in and were in. And I was flabbergasted by that pain. I still continue to be flabbergasted by that pain. It's going to make me cry a little bit because, like, these are people that I love who are going through something that is as painful as childbirth, you know, like it's like they're rebirthing themselves and going through family issues and whatever, colleague issues and friend issues and leaving something that has been a part of their lives since they were born. And I just hurt. I hurt for people who go through faith transitions. Of course, they come out of it usually and they're happier and stronger and more fulfilled than they were before. But the pain that people walk through it astounds me. And so that weekend I got a glimpse of that pain and I realized this job was exactly really why I was here. And why I'm really here, I still think, is to just walk with people and, listen to people and just be there sitting with them in that pain. And it's hard sometimes, but I love this job. I love being here in Utah. I think I was born for this job. because I feel like I was certainly called to be here, even though I have not gone through that pain. I have not walked through that pain myself. I've been Community Christ my whole life. And like you said earlier, my voice has always been valued and listened to, and I've never known a life where that wasn't true. But now I can imagine it a little bit better, what it's like, because I've been here for 2.5 years almost, and I've sat with many, many people and listened to how difficult it is. So I think this job as a Latter-day Seeker minister fits me better than any job I've ever had in my entire life. That includes being a math teacher. That includes being a Mission Center financial officer. This is just a really good fit. And I really, really enjoy it.
I was going to say, though, that I think there's a big benefit from having someone here in Utah, a woman here in Utah, who has always had their voice heard. Because at least for me, I know when I started meeting Community of Christ members who don't remember life before 1984 or 1985, Section 156. Yeah, okay. It was almost jarring in a way, but really, really energizing for me. Because I could kind of see a glimpse of what my children's experience was going to be like. You know, my little 8-year-old girls, I just feel like they're going to be little Carlas. And if they're, I mean, not necessarily to follow your path in the church, but that they're going to be grown women who don't question their voice, who don't question their value, who don't question their worth. And that is not something that I was afforded at all. And so to have somebody who has walked that path of just, you know, this is the fruits of equality. Not that we've completely arrived and we've hit the mark, of course, but I think that it's brought just a real sense of stability and hope to Utah. So not to like get all mushy gushy about Carla, but I think it's been great. It's been really great.
I feel like I have been given this confidence that I really hope that, like you said, the second generation here in Utah will kind of take for granted in some ways. Mm-hmm. Like I want them to be able to say, yeah, I'm important. Duh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I am important.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if I'm a boy, I'm a girl, I'm a lesbian, I'm whatever. I'm important and my voice matters. Like mm-hmm. that, if that is all that we do here, then that's worth it.
Yeah.
That's enough.
Yeah. So I guess to wrap up, we're about ready to hit the 1-hour mark. This has been a really good overview of your story, and I think that it gives a lot of background to the kinds of interviews that you have on Project Zion podcast and the people that you're able to talk to and the conversations that you're able to have. So I guess I'm curious to know your thoughts on, I don't know if I want to say podcasting in the church or telling stories, like the bigger conversation that I guess podcasts afford us to have, because I think that I know when you first started the podcast, you joined the PZP team. I was really, really, really excited because I felt like, yes, somebody who knows people who's been around the world who, you know, and to get those diverse experiences and conversations that I just didn't feel like I could really tap into. I just feel like I'm now, you know, praising Carla, but I feel like you've been a really good asset to the podcast because of that. So I just want to hear your thoughts on podcasting in general or sharing diverse voices and stories via the podcast. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Everyone who's listening to this probably now realize what an extrovert I am. I love people. Like if I'm by myself for more than 4 hours, I'm just like a slug on the couch. I cannot even move. I'm like, I need people to survive. And sometimes I'll just like go to Target and just like talk to random strangers just so I can get some energy. I need people to survive. And it is perfectly clear to me. It might not be clear to anybody else in the whole church. I think it is, but it is perfectly clear to me that relationships will save this church. Mm. If we need saving, I don't even know if we need saving, but relationships are what make the foundation of this church and what make this church so incredible. And so I think anytime we can hear someone's story, anytime we have the chance and the gift to hear someone speak about what's real for them and true for them and genuine for them, it's just that, it's a gift. And we understand each other better. We get to see, like I said before, we get to see how they see God, and it helps us see God more clearly. You know, there's just been so many moments in my life when I've been like, this church isn't going to make it. This church is not going to make it. And then like in the next second or minute or hour or day, I will receive a phone call from someone and I will just be immediately like, we're fine. Look at us. We love each other. We're here together. We want to be together. We have these blessings in this community, and we are going to be fine. Relationships are going to save us. So anytime we can hear someone's story, anytime we can tell our story is, I think, a huge blessing, a huge gift that we can give. And anytime we can be real and vulnerable with someone, whew, like, I now know how difficult that is and how scary that is, but how incredibly important that is. So I think this podcast, even though, you know, you're listening to it in your car or on your iPhone or while you're running.
We were just talking about exercising. We're both not runners.
So even though you're not like in the physical presence of someone, you might run into them someday and you're like, oh, I know something about her. I know something about Carla. She had her leg grabbed in the Philippines or something like that, you know? And then you can start a conversation and you can be in relationship with that person. So for me, I think it's an incredible gift.
Thank you. I was hoping you would say something like that. Not that I wanted to coach you too much, but
you did good.
But no, I agree. And I think that that's one of the biggest, you know, to use your word that you didn't really want to use, blessing, that I have experienced through this church and specifically through this podcast is just quote unquote meeting people that I haven't had a chance to meet in person yet, or that I have just briefly, and then getting to know them a little bit better through the podcast. So I'm really, really glad. I feel like I'm really, really glad that we were able to record this episode. I feel like it's long overdue. And now that we're neighbors, we finally got to do it.
Well,
thank you.
I appreciate the chance to do it. Brittany and I, yeah, we were discussing like some podcasts that we're going to do. And I'm like, well, you know, like we never had one where people heard my story. I don't know if people are interested in my story. So lovely listener, you'll have to tell me if you are interested or not, but I appreciate the chance to actually tell it because I remembered a few things that I had forgotten. And, you know, going back through your own story, you're like, yeah, I am precisely where God has called me to be. And there's many times I feel like I've just been prepped this entire time to be here. And then who knows where I'll be in 10 years. And this time was prepping for that time as well. So I'm grateful for the walk down memory lane and all of those crazy, crazy times that I had. I have many, many more stories. Someday you might hear those too on random podcasts.
The White Giant.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.